I think our discussion in these five talks will be rather more than usually important. For we hope to bring in a quantity of material involving principles and points of doctrine we have never before discussed. And as a beginning, I would like to lay certain foundations. In the first place, however, we must bear in mind that it is very easy in an obscure area to fall into opinion or to interpret somewhat more broadly than the facts justify, especially if we work from some basic conviction of our own. Therefore, I'm not going to dogmatize any of these points, merely to bring out, where possible, the historical facts and certain almost inevitable conclusions. Each person, however, should weigh these almost inevitable remarks with the same criticism and judgment that they would use in evaluating any body of evidence or circumstantial record. I want to deal first with two very interesting and unusual centuries. That 200-year period from approximately 100 B.C. to 100 A.D. The more we become interested in comparative religion, the more we realize that this particular period has interest and importance in widely scattered areas of human culture. Of course, in the midst of this period, the Western world received the impact of Christianity. But it must also be borne in mind that the Christian faith for the first two or three centuries was a minority doctrine developing within a very restricted geographical and cultural area. We cannot, therefore, assume that Christianity of itself was responsible for all the other changes in distant regions, far from the possible contact with early Christian activity. Nor can we more readily assume that far and distant areas moved in upon the Mediterranean region to completely change European culture. We must therefore move from a generality to be weighed and considered. We know that about 600 years before the beginning of the Christian era, a group of extraordinary religious and philosophical leaders arose within the space of 100 years. Many of these men were contemporaries, and each left an indelible mark upon the culture of his own time and the area in which he lived. China received Confucius and Lao Tzu, who were contemporaries, although Lao Tzu was the elder man. During the very lifetime of these men, India received Buddha, another of the great teachers of the world. We have the suspicion that there was a marked renaissance of Persian culture about this time, perhaps under the last of the Zoroasters, who, it is said, Pythagoras of Samos was personally acquainted with. In Greece, it was Pythagoras who established the foundations of the great age of philosophy, which may well be termed the golden age of Greek learning. Here were a variety of impulses bestowed almost simultaneously in different parts of the world. From this period, there moves a cycle of approximately 600 years. Let us say between 500 and 600. In each case, within its own area, these foundations laid in the 6th century B.C. began to mature and evolve and develop systems of thought. We know what happened in Greece and how the Platonic philosophy rose definitely from the Pythagorean theory. We also realize that Pythagoreanism and Platonism became the dominant Mediterranean philosophies and attained this distinction between the 4th century B.C. and the 1st century B.C. We also realize that in China, the peculiar nature of Confucianism caused it to remain a very steady and comparatively unchanging structure. Confucianism was almost totally an ethical conviction, and it could scarcely be changed or outlawed any more than we could actually change the Golden Rule. Its very structure did not permit it to become much involved in any religious or abstract formula. But Taoism, the teaching of Lao Tzu, at about the beginning of the Christian era, moved from a philosophical to a theological foundation. And we find a tremendous expansion of Chinese metaphysics coinciding closely with, say, the 1st century A.D. At about the same time, we find a tremendous internal change in the structure of Buddhism. We find, as the result of the discovery of the mysterious secret books of Buddha in the Iron Tower by the Buddhist patriarch Nagarjuna, the Buddhism moved from a lofty philosophic agnosticism into a very involved, profound, and emotionally mature metaphysics. With the advent of the Pure Land Doctrine, or the Northern School, Mahayana Buddhism. As soon as Mahayana arose, the entire course of Buddhist history changed. And while there are still groups clinging strongly to the old way, most of the progress in Buddhism has been the result of the Mahayana groups operating in China, Korea, and Japan. They have represented the spearhead of the modernism of religion in Asia. About the same period, there were marked changes in Hinduism. The rise of mystical and transcendental schools for the interpretation of the ancient Vedic and Puranic writings. This change was also an enlargement into mysticism, a tremendous growth of metaphysical speculation, and the development of systems of meditation and various types of mystical experience doctrines, which were to play an important part in Asiatic culture. Even while Christianity was in its infancy, its direction was abruptly changed at almost the same time by the ministry of St. Paul. The Christianity of the four Gospels has gradually been absorbed into the Christology of the Epistles, and St. Paul stands forth as the person who transformed the moral code of Jesus into a highly transcendental universal doctrine of regeneration and redemption. Similar changes were occurring in Persian metaphysics. And we find the roots appearing also in Greek speculation. For about the beginning of the Christian era, the simple philosophic clarity of Plato's thinking became involved in the highly mystical speculations of the Neoplatonists and the Neopythagoreans, seated in that melting pot of commerce and culture, the ancient North African city of Alexandria. Also in this same time, cross groups began to emerge, mingling Greek thought with thinking of Christianity, and producing such peculiar groups as the Gnostics and the followers of Manes, the Manichaean group. In all of these instances, one simple point stands out. The gradual transformation of older doctrines into highly mystical revelations. Revelations that had one essential purpose behind them. And that was to change the concept of the transcendence of deity to the concept of the immanence of deity. This is a very important philosophical point. The mysterious God of old, or the godlings of ancient times, living in their remote Olympian or Samurian heights, were a race of beings apart, inhabitants of heaven. But in this gradual change that took place, deity was transformed into an eternal power, everywhere present, always invisible, beyond definition, yet immediately available through certain transcendent achievements of human consciousness. We know that this change marked not only the shift in the psychological integration of the Mediterranean region, but that it swept across the world. There are even vestiges of this change occurring in the Western Hemisphere among the primitive peoples, perhaps not so primitive peoples, of Central America. We find a gradual tendency to associate the rise of religious mysticism among the Mayas at a time approximating the beginning of the Christian era. This phenomenon was so remarkable that Lord Kingsborough, one of the greatest 19th century authorities on Central American culture, felt that it was almost certain that the mysterious deity Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, who came so strangely to Mexico, must have been one of the original apostles. In other words, there seemed no other way of explaining this, because there was no common communication between these peoples. Yet at almost one time, they all came to an almost identical conclusion, changed their entire religious course, and transformed the structure of religion from its archaic form to the type of religious understanding which we share and enjoy today. Now, this obviously opens a very large area of speculation. There are many possible explanations, some rather impossible, which have still held a measure of favor. One broadly accepted doctrine relating to this, or explanation for the circumstances, is the idea of coincidental emergence. We have parallels of this in simpler ways. We frequently hear, for example, of an invention that has been offered to the world. And it is not uncommon that the same invention shall appear in different places at the same time. several persons coming to almost identical conclusions and at almost the identical moment. Therefore, the coincidence concept is not quite as loose as might first appear, for it is based upon the assumption that time is measured by a series of events, and that whenever a culture or a group of persons or a civilization passes through certain experiences, there are corresponding innovations in that culture, changes in its doctrines and beliefs. Perhaps the interval of 600 years between the advent of the great teachers and the beginning of the Christian era brought several nations or several culture groups to almost the same psychological platform. And there was no direction in which they could go except that direction which is most natural and common to human nature. Another explanation, which requires perhaps a little more investigation, is the concept that these changes were tied together, that actually there was greater commerce between these ancient cultures than we at this time assume to have existed. That it is quite possible that by the beginning of the Christian era, a degree of world thought had been established, particularly along the caravan routes. And it is interesting that most of these innovations rose in regions along the caravan lines between Europe and Asia. Therefore, it is conceivable that Asiatics did visit Western centers of learning. It is also quite possible that more Europeans visited Asia than we now realize. We know that Pythagoras was able in the 6th century B.C. to reach India. We know that the armies of Alexander the Great penetrated Asia. We do not know just how largely these motions contributed to world ideas. But one thing we can generally regard as undeniable, that the world of cultured, civilized nations came to about the same ideas at almost the same time. Of course, to the devout transcendentalist or metaphysician, there is no problem at all. All these things are handled by invisible forces beyond human comprehension. We do not deny such a possibility, but we also like to see, if possible, some more simple and explainable procedure. These transcendental solutions belong to the divine emergencies, and I would rather see first, if we cannot find some common ground for assuming that these changes were made by at least partially natural means. And I think we can rather well establish this. Now, you may wonder why all this has a bearing upon the Kabbalah and the doctrines of the early Jewish peoples. The importance lies in this very circumstance, namely, that Kabbalism is perhaps the broadest term that we have for Jewish transcendentalism. Kabbalism is, to the old Orthodox Jewish belief, almost in the same relationship as Mahayana Buddhism to primitive Buddhism in India, or the theological Taoism to the primitive absolutism of Laozi. In each instance, we see the arising of a new point of view. And in the case of the Kabbalists, this presents a semi-Western face for our examination. It is a rather compact package. It involves a limited group of persons, yet it is wonderfully symbolical of the entire world procedure. Not only are we concerned with these extraordinary coincidences and the timing, but we are also somewhat concerned with the internal symbolism of the various revelations that arose in a half a dozen areas of world culture at the same time. In the symbolism, we also seem to sense a relatedness. The symbolism would almost suggest that a number of people had read the same book or had become aware of the same basic facts or had attained to the same basic conviction and had then unfolded this illumination in terms familiar to their own people or in terms at least partly acceptable to the entrenched traditionalism of the areas in which they existed. Well, we must realize that all of these groups were opposed as they rose. They all passed through certain persecutions. They created resentments. They were declared to be heretical by someone. And perhaps it was this very persecution that gave to each of them the strong substance of survival. For we know things under persecution develop a tremendous strength and an integration that can never be found in more fortunate environments. So we have now a world situation. And I think that the Dead Sea Scrolls situation more or less fits into this. These scrolls are assumed to have been originally preserved or put away in the earth sometime in this interval between 100 B.C. and 100 A.D. We also have to remember that in these scrolls there are strong indications of a heterodox attitude arising among Jewish mystical sects. I am no way convinced that these scrolls are Essene products. I do not think the Essenian community can be actually the source of them, although it may well have been the preserver of the old manuscripts. The Essenes themselves were a transition group between Orthodox Judaism and mysticism, and their entire history is noted only in these two mysterious centuries. After that, they disappear utterly from the pages of record and account. We do not know what happened to them, but they form part of this strange bridge of doctrines that seem to connect an old world with a new concept of life. How shall we distinguish this new concept of life, for instance, in terms of our Kabbalism? The great book of the Kabbalah, certainly its outstanding text today, is the Sefer HaZohar, or the Book of the Splendors. This was first given to the world around the 12th or 13th century by Rabbi Moses de Leon. He insisted that he transcribed it from an ancient work. For nearly 300 years, perhaps 400 years, historians have thrown the lie to his teeth. They have said that Rabbi Moses wrote the work himself, that it had no roots in antiquity, and probably little, if any, roots in tradition. However, in the last century, our broadening knowledge of world culture has caused a general change of opinion. And even so conservative a publication as the Encyclopedia Britannica, which can never be said to give much benefit to abstractions. Their article on the Kabbalah states as the modern point of view that it is very probable that Rabbi Moses of Leon either was in possession of an earlier manuscript or was in possession of a valid oral tradition, and that in all probabilities he was perfectly honest and perfectly sincere and entirely truthful in attributing the Zohar to a very much earlier date than the medieval scholars had admitted. According to Rabbi Moses, this work was actually written about the beginning of the Christian era, just at this particularly critical time during the reign of the Roman Emperor Vespasian. Persecuted by the Romans and by the more traditionally bound members of the Sanhedrin, Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai retired to a cave with his son. And in this cave he was visited by one of the angelic host. And through this angelic visitor and the intercession of the early prophets, he is said to have recorded the Book of the Splendors, the Sefer HaZohar. We have at this time no reason to doubt that this book is a genuine midrash of Rabbi Simeon. That is, it was a work prepared by him, or at least committed to memory as the result of instruction which he gave. This particular work changed the entire complexion of Jewish thought. It belongs just as certainly to this transition period as the wonderful books found by Nagarjuna in the Iron Tower in India at almost exactly the same date. All this adds to the concept that prevails in the writings of Rabbi Simeon and in a parallel group of material prepared by Rabbi Akiba. A little later, Philo Judaeus, the most articulate philosophical spokesman of the Greco-Jewish school, expanded this concept of Jewish mysticism far more than had been previously possible, and mingled its courses very closely with Neoplatonism. This was a very interesting time, a time of strange beliefs. Each people, in its own way, has explained the reason why that particular period should have produced these curious consequences. But there must have been some broader underlying generality which binds these together and makes them into one united idea. For example, among the teachings that arose among the Kabbalists and probably may be traced back to Simeon ben Yochai in the first century is the doctrine of Gilgulim. This particular doctrine is not commonly found in the West during the period of the so-called rise of Kabbalism. The word simply means the doctrine of rebirth. Now, the Orthodox Jewish people had certain beliefs about this, but they were not at all clearly defined. It is held that the Pharisees did hold this doctrine in some estimation, and certain sects also regarded it highly. But with the rise of Kabbalism, it burst upon the philosophic mind of Europe. Now, here's one of the points which I think we are mentioning perhaps for the first time, and that is the descent of the doctrine of rebirth in Europe from the fall of the Greek schools to the rise of modern knowledge. This doctrine was perpetuated in Europe. It was perpetuated not only by Jewish Kabbalists, but by Christian Kabbalists. And there was a thin thread of this belief, even in the Dark Ages, and in the period of the Renaissance, and down through the dawn of the modern way of thinking, with its indebtedness to Galileo, Harvey, Descartes, and other dawn thinkers of our modern generation. So this teaching suddenly flares up among the Jewish mystics. Why? How is it that a doctrine which had so little sympathy from their Christian neighbors and so little support from the Torah should have been developed in such exquisite detail in the Sefer HaZohar? This book was widely read and was widely influential among the literary-minded Jewish people. It attacked many principles of Orthodox Jewry. It did not permit much of the psychological pattern that has always dominated Jewish personal and family life. It violated, in many respects, at least the prevalent interpretations of the Torah and the Mosaic Code. Yet it flourished in Spain, in Italy, in France, and was held by a large number of scholarly believers all the way down through the reigns of the Medicis and the Borgias. It's almost incredible to assume that a whole series of these doctrines moving westward, doctrines which were essentially so close to the Asiatic pattern of life, could simply have come from nowhere, or merely represented the speculations of single persons. Here we have another example of the development of traditions. These traditions bore very heavily upon the nature of the divine being at the root of life. And in the rise of the Zohar, we see the Jewish concept of deity undergoing marked changes. Changes which were later to profoundly influence the Christian faith. How did these changes arise and where did they come from? Were they indigenous to Europe or the Near East? Or did they come from far Asia? As time goes on, I believe the general tendency will be to suspect far Asia. I think we will gradually be forced by the development of more adequate records to recognize that religion is a common motion, that it is like a river that may flow through one country but have its headwaters in another. And this diffusion of ideas was possible at the time with which we are most concerned. And it is very possible that the reason for this sudden outburst of similar doctrines in assorted regions came as the result of the maturing or developing of more adequate travel facilities, particularly the increase of caravan trade. The trade was to provide luxuries for the Romans and the Latins, but the byproduct was the communication of ideas. For these traders brought with them their beliefs and their doctrines. We know that this trading process, a few centuries later, was to be the principal foundation for the rise of Islam. But for our present concern, I think the transformation of the nature of deity is the first matter to be considered. Our primitive ancestors gradually passed from the worship of nature to the worship of spirits, from the recognition of visible forces to the acceptance of invisible causes behind or beyond these forces. These causes themselves passed through innumerable reformations on the part of man. As his experience increased, it became essential to revise his theology, to keep his theology abreast of his intellectual achievements and his physical experiences. Gradually, the concept of deity as represented in the Mosaic Code took form, not in one area, but in many areas. And deity emerged as a being, a transcendent person. As the system was patriarchal, the deity assumed the aspect of the great father power. It was usually personified or impersonated as a most venerable person, a great superhuman being. A being, however, fashioned in the likeness of a man. A being like the mysterious and noble figure casting from his hands the sun and moon, as represented on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome. This being was the great patriarch and was compounded out of the elders, the heroes of long ago, the fathers of tribes, the venerated sages and scholars, the great priests and saints of long ago. All of these contributed their parts to the creation of the God image. And this God image was great of power, universal of authority, but subject, like the creatures that fashioned it, to the whimsies of disposition and temperament. Subject naturally to favoritism in bringing particular advantage and security to its chosen people. This God image was remote, like perhaps the great golden figure of Zeus at Olympus. It was power, but it was a power inscrutable, a power with which man could have very little intimate understanding association. It was a power that ran all things according to its own will. And in this power, men were but pawns in a great game. The gods could sweep away men merely by the will to do so. And these gods lived in a heaven world or region far from the abode of men, even though, like ancient Odin, they occasionally seated themselves upon the throne of all-seeing and looked out upon the world to see that it was still in order. We find this kind of deity not only arising in the Near East, but having already arisen in other ancient regions as Egypt, India, and China. We find roots of it in the nature worship of Japan, Shinto. We see, therefore, God as the ancestor. We see God as the ancient one. And we also lived in a world ruled by certain inscrutable laws and processes, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This God was a God of justice and of vengeance. This was the deity whom men did not dare to offend. They could respect, they could fall in awe before the thought or image of this God, but they could not meet it with personal affection. It was too distant and too far, too high, too remote to have any immediate part in the workings of the world. This concept also had another frailty about it, which men, as they grew wiser, began to contemplate. There was a weakness in this God. For this deity, living alone in an inscrutable internal remoteness, was assumed to be the parent of creation. In the first place, man was unable to explain how or even why God should create. There seemed to be no particular reason for it, and the more men studied the creation, particularly other men, the more doubt they had in the divine wisdom in creating man in the first place. There were many legends that deity so repented of this optimistic moment that he swept away his creation time and time again. This problem also caused the great question to arise, from what was creation fashioned? Did creation actually emerge as a result of a divine fiat spoken in space by some vast shadowy being like that portrayed by Gustave Doré in some of his wonderful paintings? Was creation from something or nothing? From what did the eternal creator fashion his world? Was the world created, or had it always existed? Was deity merely one of a body of immortal beings that, like existence itself, had no beginning and no end? The problem of trying to rationalize the fashioning of a world by this strange and mysterious power confused and confounded the ablest thinkers of old time. They could figure nothing more than a symbolical answer, like the tossing off of the sun in front and the moon behind. This, however, did not fully satisfy the rising realization of the principles of astronomy. There had to be some other explanation. This explanation needed also a warmth in it. And if we look back on primitive religion, we see that there was an astonishing lack of real warmth. Men worshiped. But some way this worship was like the respect of a small child to an overstern parent. It was a respect of fear. This deity was wonderful and awful. It was a being which no one dared to offend. It was a father, however, in name only, for no one brought their troubles to this father. They brought offerings, they propitiated, they prayed, but they never felt a kinship with infinite life. This was long regarded as one of the basic weaknesses of Greek religion. Of all the religions of that period, probably the Greek was the most pleasant. It was the happiest. It was a worship of nature, and the rituals were well arranged, so there were festivities for every season. But even so, this did not represent a real sense of intimate experience. It was not until the rise of the Orphics that the human being in Greece had any real spiritual significance. He died and became a shadow. He had neither punishment nor reward in the world to come. He came forth as a flower and was cut down. And that was the story of him. It was only after philosophy began to ripen these concepts, and the human heart began to sense an internal need that it turned away from the strange theological materialism of antiquity. This does not mean that the ancients had no God, but they had no personal God experience. They only worshiped before the temple. They never seemed to go in to find that which was hidden in the adytum. They did not walk with God. Perhaps the old story that before the fall of man, God walked in the garden in the cool of the evening, carried some remembrance of other and better ways. But in the great rise of theology, God did not walk with men. He ruled them. He governed them. He punished them and rewarded them according to his own will and fancy. Now, it is quite possible that at a certain degree of cultural insight, many nations simultaneously outgrew this concept. We know that most of the countries where these changes took place were comparatively advanced in their sciences, their literature, their art, their poetry, their drama, and in their morality and ethics. Regardless of this particular point, however, we know they all did come to this immediate sensing of a great and wonderful need. To meet this need, a new type of thinking had to be devised. For there was a very deep problem here, one that the modern world probably will never fully comprehend, or with which we may again be confronted one of these days when we make a sudden shift from materialism to idealism. If we produce a culture which remains materialistic for several centuries, and then this culture, out of emergency within itself, seeks to reestablish its own spiritual foundations, we may know something of what these peoples went through 2,000 years ago, because it required a tremendous shift of perspective. One of the important phases of this shift was the relationship between the individual and his own personal responsibilities. In the ancient world, the gods bestowed or withheld. Their ways were not only inscrutable, but as far as man was concerned, unreasonable. There seemed to be no particular way of explaining why the unjust seemed to flourish and the just to suffer. There seemed to be no reasonable explanation for the disasters and tragedies of human existence. Therefore, it seemed reasonable to assume that a deity, perhaps with insight beyond our own, was the administrator of all this wonderful complexity. But about the beginning of the Christian era, there came into existence the tremendous sense of personal responsibility for destiny. It shines out at us through all of these different systems. Man's fate moves slowly into man's own keeping. This was not a sudden move, but it was a rapid one. And in this concept, it was necessary to revise previous attitudes. So we see a marked change in a number of beliefs. One of these marked changes included the rise of at least an archetypal form of the messianic dispensation. All of these peoples suddenly became aware of a power of intercession in space. This is particularly obvious in the Jewish instance, for among these people
the power of intercession had been comparatively slightly developed as a doctrine. But among the Kabbalists, it arises in a very powerful way. We find also in India the strict teachings of Buddha are enlarged. Buddha passed through two processes after his death. By one of these processes, he was deified. And by the other process, he was, we will say, absorbed into a structure of bodhisattvas, of celestial beings and attendants who ministered to the spiritual needs of mankind. A savior concept emerged. Now, at almost exactly the time of the rise of the mystical dispensation in Christendom, the Buddhist concept evolved their belief in a deity whom they called Amitabha, the Buddha of boundless light. This Amitabha power was seated like a remote deity in the effulgency of space. But Amitabha was not a god in fact or substance. Amitabha was a human being deified by merit. After Amitabha had preserved his vow, or kept his great vow, which he made before attaining to the estate of an arhat, he became the ruler of the Golden Land, the Land of Peace, the New Jerusalem of Christianity, the city four square, represented often in this actual way in China, Tibet, and Japan. Amitabha then caused to emerge from his own nature the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara, his beloved son. This Bodhisattva became his representative, his intercessor. And it is in the keeping of this Bodhisattva that Amitabha entrusted his world. And it was the duty and responsibility of Avalokitesvara to bring all souls to salvation through the grace of his own nature. Now, this concept was in vogue in Asia, rising mysteriously and miraculously in the first century A.D. Avalokitesvara later becomes a male-female being, and in China and Japan is often disassociated entirely from its masculine attributes to become Kuan Yin or Kannon. A purely feminine representation, now depicted carrying a small child in her arms. And this particular circumstance so disconcerted the first Christian missionaries in the area that they were convinced that in some way these people were perverting the idea of the Virgin Mary. But here we have this concept arising on the opposite side of the world. We have a similar concept gradually unfolding into the later religion of the Egyptians, where a comparatively unimportant local deity, Osiris, finally became the principal deity of Egypt, and then became the father of his own mysteriously, immaculately conceived son, Horus, who in turn becomes the savior of the world. The story of Horus is almost identically, in function, the story of Avalokitesvara. We find also in many other systems either personified beings representing salvation, as in the emergence of the Persian Mithras, but we also find the rise of doctrines of salvation revealed by beings who so loved mankind that they opened the royal roads of revelation. The whole picture fits together in a strange and interesting manner. Now, in the beginning of Amidaism, as it is called in Japan, or the doctrine of Amitabha, we have the meaning. The Amitabha exists in two forms in Chinese Tibetan philosophy. One is Amitabha, the Buddha of boundless light. The other is Amitayus, the Buddha of boundless life. These two are reflexes of each other, and in the Tibetan art are regarded as aspects of one being. And the Word was light, and the light was the life of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. This is practically a Christian statement of Buddhist philosophy. Now, how did the doctrine get across? Or, let us go to the Kabbalah now. The Kabbalists no longer accepted the mysterious name of deity that is concealed under the acrostic of the Tetragrammaton, or the great name of four letters, which we have translated Jehovah. They declared that the mysterious power at the root of life, the Ancient of Days, that power which is eternal and immovable, is of a triadic nature, represented by three words, Ein, boundlessness. That is that which is foreverness of its own eternal nature. That which goes on without beginning or end, representing an essence, a principle unchanging unto infinity. That never this power was born, that this power shall never die. But very much like the effort made by Aristotle to establish the causelessness of first cause, simply represents the fact that causation is itself eternal. That causation is both a motion and a substance, existing forever. This is almost identically the statement of Lao Tzu in describing the nature of Tao. And this was the same doctrine which at the beginning of the first century took over in China, at about the same period that we find it rising in North Africa, the Near East, and Southern Europe. Out of the nature of Ein comes Ein Sof. And Ein Sof is the boundless life. And out of the boundless life comes Ein Sofer in the ancient Kabbalah. And that is the boundless light. So being, life, and light constitute the basic triad of the Kabbalah. Being, life, and light constitute the basic triad of Mahayana Buddhism. There is no essential difference. There is only such difference as would be inevitably the result of translation from one language to another. So Buddhism no longer remained a doctrine of the world of illusion and the total reality of a nirvana beyond. It now became a world filled with being, life, and light. And this triad became gradually further exemplified out of the nature of Amitabha, by the rise of this triad consisting of Amitayus, Avalokitesvara, and Daisechi, the being.